Disc 11.
That day, the company got the news that President Roosevelt had died. Winters wrote in his daybook, "Sergeant Malley of F Company, good news, made first sergeant. Bad news, President Roosevelt died." "I had come to take Roosevelt for granted," Webster wrote his parents, "like spring and Easter lilies. And now that he is gone, I feel a little lost." Eisenhower ordered all unit commanders to hold a short memorial service for Roosevelt on Sunday, April 14th. Easy Company did it by platoons. Lieutenant Foley, who never was much enamored with Roosevelt, gathered his platoon. He had a St. Joseph missal in his musette bag. In it he found a prayer. He read it out to the men and later claimed to be the only man who ever buried Franklin D. as a Catholic. Overall, Easy's time on the Rhine guarding the Ruhr pocket was boring. "Time hung so heavily," a disgusted Webster wrote, "that we began to have daily rifle inspections. Otherwise, we did nothing but stand guard on the crossroads at night and listen to a short current events lecture by Lieutenant Foley during the day." With their high energy level and the low demands on them, the men turned to sports. They found some rackets and balls and played tennis on a backyard court, or softball in a nearby field. Webster was no athlete, but he had a high level of curiosity. One day he realized the fulfillment of a lifetime ambition when he and Private John Genovec scaled a 250-foot-high factory smokestack. When they got to the top, they had a magnificent view across the river. To Webster, the Ruhr seemed absolutely lifeless, even though everywhere we looked, there were factories, foundries, steel mills, sugar plants, and sheet metal works. It looked like Chicago, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis decentralized. On April 18th, all German resistance in the Ruhr pocket came to an end. More than 325,000 German soldiers surrendered. Easy was put to guarding a displaced persons camp at Dormagen. There were Poles, Czechs, Belgians, Dutch, French, Russians, and others from different parts of Nazi-occupied Europe in the camp, tens of thousands. They lived in a common barracks, segregated by sex, crowded, all but starving in many cases, representing all ranges of age. Once liberated, their impulse was to catch up on their rest and their fun, so sadly lacking for the past few years. Webster reported that they were contentedly doing nothing. They had worked hard under the Germans and eaten little. Now they would rest. Their happiness, singing, and willingness to do favors for the soldiers endeared them to the men of Easy. KP was now a thing of the past. No member of Easy ever peeled a potato after this point, or swept a room, or washed a mess kit, or policed the area. There were always DPs for that, especially as the Americans were so generous in paying. More than a few men took along a combination son and servant. Lutz practically adopted a thin little boy, Muchik, who wore battered shoes much too large. His parents had died in the slave labor camp. Muchik's big dark eyes and bright energetic demeanor were irresistible to Lutz. He got Muchik a uniform of sorts and brought him along for the tour of Germany, teaching him the fundamentals of army profanity as they rode along. As the division history notes, though strict orders were given that no DPs were to be taken along, some of the personnel spoke very broken English, never appeared in formations, and seemed to do a great deal of kitchen police. In short, Easy was about to depart on a tour of Germany that would be first class in every way. Comfortable homes each night, great food and wine, free to take almost whatever they wanted, being driven along an autobahn reserved for them, riding at a leisurely pace on big rubber tires with wondrous sights to see. The dramatic Alps on one side, the dramatic disintegration of what had been the most feared army in the world on the other, with body servants to care for their every need. Except one. They would have loved to have brought some of the DP girls along, but they did no better with them than they had with the German girls. Like GIs everywhere, they assumed that a D-ration and a couple of Chelseas were the key to any woman's heart, only to be disappointed. The second generation Czechs and Poles in the company had been especially excited. They spent all their spare time, night and day, using their limited language ability to court the stocky, balloon-chested peasant girls of their father's native lands. But contrary to their expectations, the girls, with their Catholic upbringing and Central European background, were chaste. For Webster, the effect of the DP camp was to stir up his hatred of the Germans. Why were these people here? He asked himself about the DPs. They had done nothing, had no politics, committed no crime, possessed nothing. They were there because the Nazis needed their labor. There was Germany and all it stood for, Webster concluded. The Germans had taken these people from their homes and sentenced them to work for life in a factory in the Third Reich. Babies and old women, innocent people, condemned to live in barracks behind barbed wires, to slave 12 hours a day for an employer without feeling or consideration, to eat beet soup, moldy potatoes, and black bread. This was the Third Reich. This was the New Order. Work till you died. With cold deliberation, the Germans had enslaved the populace of Europe. So far as Webster was concerned, the German people were guilty, every one of them. The guard duty lasted only a few days. Back on the Rhine, Winters instituted a training schedule that included reveille, inspection, calisthenics, and close-order drill, squad tactics, map reading, and so forth. The day ended with retreat. It was like being back in basic training and much resented. As always, in a rear echelon area, rank was being pulled, widening the distance between the enlisted men and the officers. Lieutenant Ralph D. Ritchie, a gung-ho replacement officer serving as Battalion S1, was particularly obnoxious. One day, he had the company lined up for inspection. An old German woman rode her bicycle innocently through the ranks. Ritchie became so enraged that he fetched her a blow that knocked her off her bicycle. She burst into tears. He stormed at her and ordered her to move on. The men were disgusted by his behavior. The following day, the company made a forced 5-mile speed march, Lieutenant Ritchie leading. The men rolled up their sleeves and carried their weapons as comfortably as possible. Ritchie was furious. He halted the company and gave the men hell. "I have never seen such a sloppy company," he shouted. "There are 120 men in this company, and I see 120 different ways of carrying a rifle. And you guys think you're soldiers." The incident set Webster off on a tirade. Here was a man who had made us ashamed of our uniform, railing at us for being comfortable on a speed march, he wrote. Here was the army. "Officers are gentlemen. I'll do as I damn please. No back talk. You're a private. You can't think. If you were any good, you'd be an officer. Here, carry my bedroll. Sweep my room. Clean my carbine." "Yes, sir." "Why didn't you salute?" "You didn't see me." "Well, by God, go back and salute properly." The Louis, God bless him. Privileges before responsibilities. Not all officers were like Ritchie. Captain Spears, for all his bluster and reputation, cared for the men. Sensing their boredom, he arranged a sightseeing trip to Cologne. He wanted them to see the city and the effects of air bombardment. Cologne was one of the most heavily bombed cities in Germany. Two things most impressed the men. First, the extent of the destruction. Every window was shattered. Every church had been hit. Every side street was blocked with rubble. The magnificent cathedral in the center of town had been damaged, but had survived. The giant statue of Bismarck on a horse was still standing, but Bismarck's sword, pointing toward France, had been cut off by flying shrapnel. A group of easy men wandered to the Rhine, where they began pointing and laughing at the grotesque ruins of the Hängebrücke, or suspension bridge. An elderly German couple stood beside them. To the shame of the Americans, the Germans began to cry and shake their heads. All their beautiful bridges had been twisted and mangled, and here were American boys laughing. The second impression was not of destruction, but of people. Lieutenant Foley noted that the residents on their own volition were determined to clean up and sweep out the ruins of war. Along most of the streets, there were neat stacks of salvageable cobblestones. Houses were worked on to remove the debris. They were still in bad shape, yet they appeared almost ready to be rebuilt. Amazing. April 19th was a big day for the company. The division quartermaster handed out 34 pairs of socks per platoon, or about one pair for each man, plus 3 bottles of Coca-Cola, accompanied by stern orders to turn in the bottles, and 2 bottles of American beer per man. The men got paid for February and March in the form of Allied military marks. These were their first marks, and they were ordered to turn in all their French, British, Dutch, Belgian, and American money for marks. On April 22nd, the company loaded up in the German version of the 40-8s. The cars had been sprayed with DDT and filled with straw. Each man got 5 K-rations. They were off to Bavaria and the Alps. Bradley had assigned the 101st to U.S. 7th Army. Its objectives were Munich, Innsbruck, and the Brenner Pass. The purpose was to get American troops into the Alps before the Germans could create a redoubt there from which to continue the war. Hitler's Eagle's Nest in Berchtesgaden was the presumed HQ for this combination last stand and the beginning of a guerrilla war against the occupiers. Eisenhower's biggest fear was that Hitler would get to the Eagle's Nest, where he would be well protected and have radio facilities he could use to broadcast to the German people to continue the resistance or begin guerrilla warfare. It turned out that the Germans had neither serious plans nor sufficient resources to build a mountain redoubt. But remember, we are only 4 months away from a time when everyone assumed the German army was kaput, only to be hit by the bulge. So the fear was there. But the reality was that in its drive to Berchtesgaden, Easy was as much as 100 miles behind the front line, in a reserve position, never threatened. The company's trip through Germany was more a grand tour than a fighting maneuver. The tour began with a 200-kilometer train ride through 4 countries. So great was the Allied destruction of the German rail system that to get from the Ruhr to southern Germany, it was necessary to go through Holland, Belgium, Luxembourg, and France. The men rode in open cars, sleeping, singing, swinging their feet out the doors, sunbathing on the roof of the 40-8. Popeye Wynn led them in endless choruses of the ETO theme song, "Roll Me Over in the Clover." The train passed within 25 miles of Bastogne. The division history commented, "The occasional evidence of the bitter fighting of 3 months before made the hair rise on the necks of many of the veterans of Bastogne." But at the same time, remembering only snow, cold, and dark and ominous forests, they were surprised at the beauty of the rolling lands under the new green of spring. They got back into Germany and then to the Rhine at Ludwigshafen, where they got off the train and switched to a vehicle called DUKW. D, 1942, U, amphibian, K, all-wheel drive, W, dual rear axles. These DUKWs had come in with the invasion of the south of France. These were the first E Company had seen. The DUKW was outstanding in every respect, but because it was a hybrid, neither the war nor the Navy Department ever really got behind it. Only 21,000 were built in the course of the war. The men of E Company wished it had been 210,000, or even 2,100,000. A DUKW could carry 20 fully equipped riflemen in considerable comfort. It could make 5 knots in a moderate sea, 50 miles per hour on land, riding on oversized rubber tires. It was a smooth-riding vehicle without the bounce of the deuce-and-a-half GI truck or the springless jarring of the Jeep. Webster said the DUKW rides softly up and down like a sailboat in a gentle swell. They crossed the Rhine on the Ernie Pyle Bridge, a pontoon structure built by the engineers, and headed toward Munich. They went through Heidelberg, and Webster was entranced. "When we saw all the undamaged buildings and the beautiful river promenade, where complacent civilians strolled in the sun, I was ready to stay in Heidelberg forever. The green hills, the warm sunlight, the cool, inviting river, the mellow, collegiate atmosphere. Heidelberg spelled paradise in any language." From then on, the convoy traveled a circuitous route southeast, skirting mountains, on main roads and side paths. "All the while," Webster wrote, "we marveled at the breathtaking beauty of Germany. As a writer said in the New Yorker, it seemed a pity to waste such country on the Germans." In mid-afternoon, Spears would send Sergeants Carson and Malarkey on ahead to pick out a company CP in such a village. They were to get the best house and reserve the best bedroom for Captain Spears. Carson had high school German. He would pick the place, knock on the door, and tell the Germans they had 5 minutes to get out, and they were not to take any bedding with them. Give them more than 5 minutes, Spears had told them. They will take everything with them. Once the advance party came on an apartment complex 3 stories high, perfect for HQ and most of the company. Carson knocked on doors and told tenants, "Raus in 5 minuten." They came pouring out, crying, lamenting, frightened. "I knocked on this one door," Carson recalled, "and an elderly lady answered. I looked at her and she stared at me. God, it was a picture of my own grandmother. Our eyes met and I said, 'Bleib hier,' or 'stay here.'" Malarkey picked up the story. Then Spears would finally show up and you wouldn't see Spears for about 2 or 3 hours. He was the worst looter I ever saw. He couldn't sleep at night thinking there was a necklace or something around. Whenever he got a chance, Spears would mail his loot back to his wife in England. He needed the money it would bring. His wife just had a baby. Nearly all the men of Easy, like nearly all the men in ETO, participated in the looting. It was a phenomenon of war. Thousands of men who had never before in their lives taken something of value that did not belong to them began taking it for granted that whatever they wanted was theirs. The looting was profitable, fun, low risk, and completely in accord with the practice of every conquering army since Alexander the Great's time. Lugers, Nazi insignia, watches, jewelry, first editions of Mein Kampf, liquor, were among the most sought-after items. Anything any German soldier had was fair game. Looting from civilians was frowned upon, but it happened anyway. Money was not highly valued. Sergeant Edward Heffron and medic Ralph Spina caught a half-dozen German soldiers in a house. The Germans surrendered. Heffron and Spina took their watches, a beautiful set of binoculars, and so forth. They spotted a strongbox on the shelf. Spina opened it. It was a Wehrmacht payroll in marks. They took it. In Spina's words, "There we were, two boys from South Philly, who just pulled off a payroll caper with a carbine and a pistol." Back at their apartment, Heffron and Spina debated what to do with the money as they knocked back a bottle of cognac. In the morning, they went to Mass at the Catholic Church and gave the money away to the worshippers. "With the exception of some bills of large denominations, which we split up," Spina confessed. "We weren't that drunk not to keep any for ourselves." They took vehicles of all types, private and army. Private Norman Nitzky, who had come in at Hagenau, remembered the time his squad started to drive away in a German ambulance, only to find that a German doctor with a pregnant woman was in the back trying to deliver a baby. The Americans hopped out. One morning, Lieutenant Ritchie grabbed the camera of a German woman photographing the convoy, but instead of taking it, he threw it on the ground and shot it with his pistol. This earned him the nickname the Camera Killer. Contact with the enemy picked up as the convoy moved southeast, but not in the sense of combat. The men began to see German soldiers in small groups trying to surrender, then larger groups, finally more field gray uniforms than anyone could have imagined existed. Easy Company was in the midst of a German army in disintegration. The supply system lay in ruins. All the German soldiers wanted was a safe entry into a POW cage. I couldn't get over the sensation of having the Germans, who only a short time ago had been so difficult to capture, come in from the hills like sheep and surrender, Webster wrote. When the convoy reached the Autobahn leading east to Munich, the road was reserved for Allied military traffic, the median for Germans marching west to captivity. Gordon Carson recalled that as far as you could see in the median were German prisoners, fully armed. No one would stop to take their surrender. We just waved. Webster called the sight of the Germans in the median a tingling spectacle. They came on in huge blocks. We saw the unbelievable spectacle of two GIs keeping watch on some 2,500 enemy. At that moment, the men of the company realized that the German collapse was complete. that there would be no recovery this spring as there had been last fall. There was still some scattered, sporadic resistance. Every single bridge was destroyed by German engineers as the Allies approached. Occasionally, a fanatic SS unit would fire from its side of the stream. It was more an irritant than a threat or danger. The Americans would bring forward some light artillery, drive the SS troops away, and wait for the engineers to repair the old or make a new bridge. Winters was struck by the German fanaticism, the discipline that led German engineers to blow their own bridges when the uselessness of the destruction was clear to any idiot, and the total futility of the war. Here was a German army trying to surrender and walking north along the Autobahn, while at the same time another group was blowing out the bridges to slow down the surrender. On April 29th, the company stopped for the night at Buchloe in the foothills of the Alps, near Landsberg. Here they saw their first concentration camp. It was a work camp, not an extermination camp, one of the half dozen or more that were part of the Dachau complex. But although it was relatively small and designed to produce war goods, it was so horrible that it was impossible to fathom the enormity of the evil. Prisoners in their striped pajamas, three-quarters starved by the thousands, corpses little more than skeletons by the hundreds. Winters found stacks of huge wheels of cheese in the cellar of a building he was using for the battalion CP and ordered it distributed to the inmates. He radioed to regiment to describe the situation and ask for help. The company stayed in Buchloe for 2 nights. Thus it was present in the morning when the people of Landsberg turned out, carrying rakes, brooms, shovels, and marched off to the camp. General Taylor, it turned out, had been so incensed by the sight that he had declared martial law and ordered everyone from 14 to 80 years of age to be rounded up and sent to the camp to bury the bodies and clean up the place. That evening, the crew came back down the road from the camp. Some were still vomiting. "The memory of starved, dazed men," Winters wrote, "who dropped their eyes and heads when we looked at them through the chain-link fence, in the same manner that a beaten, mistreated dog would cringe, leaves feelings that cannot be described and will never be forgotten. The impact of seeing those people behind that fence left me saying only to myself, 'Now I know why I am here.'" Chapter 17. Drinking Hitler's Champagne. Berchtesgaden, May 1st through 8th, 1945. On the first 2 days of May, the company drove south from Munich, moving slowly through streams of German soldiers walking in the opposite direction. Often there were more German soldiers with weapons going north than there were Americans going south. "We looked at each other with great curiosity," Winters remembered. "I am sure both armies shared one thought. Just let me alone. All I want is to get this over with and go home." On May 3rd, Colonel Sink got orders to have the 506th ready to move out at 09:30 the following day. Objective, Berchtesgaden. Berchtesgaden was a magnet for the troops of all the armies in southern Germany, Austria, and northern Italy. South of Salzburg, the Bavarian mountain town of Berchtesgaden was Valhalla for the Nazi gods, lords, and masters. Hitler had a home there, and a mountaintop stone retreat called the Altershorst, Eagle's Nest, 8,000 feet high. Thanks to a remarkable job of road building, cars could get to a parking place within a few hundred feet of the Altershorst. There, a shaft ran into the center of the mountain to an elevator which lifted into the Altershorst. The walls of the elevator were gold leaf. It was to Berchtesgaden that the leaders of Europe had come in the late 1930s to be humiliated by Hitler. Daladier of France, Mussolini of Italy, Schuschnigg of Austria, Chamberlain of Britain, and others. They had feared Hitler, as had the whole world. Now that Hitler was dead, the fear was removed. But that only highlighted the fascination with Hitler and his favorite retreat, which seemed to hold one of the keys to his character. It was to Berchtesgaden that the highest-ranking Nazi leadership had flocked, to be near their Führer. Himmler, Goering, Goebbels, Martin Bormann had houses in the area. There was a fabulous apartment complex for the SS. It was to the Berchtesgaden area that much of the loot collected by the Nazis from all over Europe had come. The place was stuffed with money, in gold and in currency, from a dozen countries, with art treasures. Goering's collection alone contained 5 Rembrandts, a Van Gogh, a Renoir, and much more. It was bursting with booze, jewelry, fabulous cars. So Berchtesgaden was really 2 magnets, the symbolic home of Hitler's mad lust for power and the best looting possibilities in Europe. Everybody wanted to get there, French advancing side by side with the 101st, British coming up from Italy, German leaders who wanted to get their possessions, and every American in Europe. Easy Company got there first. On May 4th, the 101st moved out by convoy down the Autobahn between Munich and Salzburg, with 2nd Battalion in the lead. The Americans passed Rosenheim and the Chiemsee. At Siegsdorf, they turned right on the direct highway to Berchtesgaden. About 14 kilometers down the road, they ran into the tail of the French 2nd Armored Division, the first division to enter Paris, with its famous commander, General Jacques-Philippe Leclerc. The 2nd Armored supposedly had been on the right flank of the 101st for the past week, but the Americans had not been able to keep in touch with it. The French were there 1 minute, gone the next. So far as the Americans could make out, they were looting their way through Germany. Whenever they got a truckload or 2 of loot, they'd send it back home to France. Now they were lusting to get into Berchtesgaden, only an hour's drive or so up into the mountains to the south. But the French were stopped by a blown bridge over a deep ravine. They did not have bridging equipment, and some SS fanatics were holding out on the south side of the ravine using automatic weapons and mortars. Easy Company and the remainder of 2nd Battalion began mixing in with the French, everyone standing around watching a long-range, useless exchange of fire while waiting for the 101st Engineers to come forward. Winters asked Sink if he wanted to send a platoon to outflank the German roadblock. "No," Sink replied. "I don't want anybody to get hurt." That was sensible. There was no point to taking casualties at this stage of the war. But there was Berchtesgaden just on the other side of the roadblock, almost in hand. Sink changed his mind. "Take the 2nd Battalion back to the Autobahn," he told Winters, "and see if you can outflank this roadblock and get to Berchtesgaden." If he succeeded, Sink wanted him to reserve the famous Berchtesgadenhof for regimental HQ. Winters led the battalion on a backtrack to the Autobahn, then east to Bad Reichenhall, where another blown bridge stopped the Americans for the night. The following morning, May 5th, with Easy Company leading the way, the 2nd Battalion drove unopposed to Berchtesgaden and took the town without having to fire a shot. It was like a fairy tale land. The snow-capped mountains, the dark green woods, the tinkling icy creeks, the gingerbread houses, the quaint and colorful dress of the natives provided a delight for the eye. The food, liquor, accommodations, and large number of Luftwaffe and Wehrmacht service women, plus camp followers of various types, provided a delight for the body. Accommodations were the first order of business. Winters and Lieutenant Welsh went to the Berchtesgadenhof. As they walked in the front door of the hotel, they could see the backs of the service personnel disappear around the corner. They went into the main dining room, where they saw a waiter putting together a large set of silverware in a 4-foot-long velvet-lined case. There was no need for orders. Winters and Welsh simply walked toward the men, who took off. The Americans split the silverware between them. 45 years later, both men were still using the Berchtesgadenhof silverware in their homes. After getting what he most wanted out of the place, Winters then put a double guard on the hotel to stop further looting. As he put it, with a straight face, in one of our interviews. But he berated himself. What a fool I was not to open the place to the 2nd Battalion. Because when regimental and then divisional HQ arrived, they took everything movable. Winters picked one of the homes of Nazi officials perched on the hillside climbing the valley out of Berchtesgaden for his battalion HQ. He told Lieutenant Coing, his S-4, to go to the place and tell the people they had 15 minutes to get out. Coing was a replacement officer who had joined up in mid-February back in Hagenau. He had not been hardened by battle. He returned a few minutes later to tell Winters, "The people said no, they would not move out." "Follow me," Winters declared. He went to the front door, knocked, and when a woman answered, he announced, "We are moving in, now." And he and his staff did just that as the Germans disappeared somewhere. Did I feel guilty about this? Winters asked himself in the interview. Did my conscience bother me about taking over this beautiful home? No. We had been living in foxholes in Normandy. We had been in the mud at Holland, the snow in Bastogne. Just a few days earlier, we'd seen a concentration camp. These people were the reason for all this suffering. I had no sympathy for their problem, nor did I feel that I owed them an explanation. Nor did the enlisted men have the slightest problem, physical or psychological, in taking over the SS barracks, an Alpine-style apartment house block that was the latest thing in modern design, plumbing, and interior decoration. Officers and sergeants got sumptuous homes of Nazi officials perched on the mountainsides overlooking Berchtesgaden. Winters set up the guard around town, mainly to direct traffic and to gather up surrendering German troops to send them to POW cages in the rear. Private Heffron was thus in command at crossroads when a convoy of 31 vehicles came down from the mountain. At its head was General Theodor Tolsdorf, commander of the 82nd Corps. He was quite a character, a 35-year-old Prussian who had almost set the record for advancement in the Wehrmacht. He had been wounded 11 times and was known to his men as Tolsdorf the Mad because of his recklessness with their lives and his own. Of more interest to E Company men, he had been in command of the 340th Volksgrenadier Division on January 3rd in the bitter fighting in the Bois Jacques and around Foy and Noville. Tolsdorf expected to surrender with full honors and then be allowed to live in a POW camp in considerable style. His convoy was loaded with personal baggage, liquor, cigars, and cigarettes, along with plenty of accompanying girlfriends. Heffron was the first American the party encountered. He stopped the convoy. Tolsdorf said he wished to surrender. Heffron summoned a nearby second lieutenant. Tolsdorf sent the lieutenant off to find someone of more suitable rank. Heffron, meanwhile, seized the opportunity to liberate General Tolsdorf's Luger and briefcase. In the briefcase, he found a couple of iron crosses and 500 pornographic photographs. He thought to himself, a kid from South Philly has a Kraut general surrendered to him. That is pretty good. Everyone was grabbing loot at a frantic pace. German soldiers were everywhere. Wehrmacht, Waffen-SS, Luftwaffe, officers, non-coms, privates, looking for someone to surrender to. And Dog, Easy, and Fox companies of the 506th were the first to get to them. From these soldiers, Webster wrote to his parents on May 13th, we obtained pistols, knives, watches, fur-lined coats, camouflage, jump jackets. Most of the Germans take it in pretty good spirit, but once in a while we get an individual who does not want to be relieved of the excess weight of his watch. A pistol flashed in his face, however, can persuade anybody. I now have a Luger, two P-38s, a Schmeisserer machine pistol, two jump smocks, one camouflage winter jacket, several Nazi flags about 3 feet by 2, and a watch. The Eagle's Nest had been thoroughly worked over by the Army Air Force. The elevator to it had been put out of action. But to men who had been up and down Currahee innumerable times, the climb to the top was more a stroll than a challenge. Alton Moore was one of the first to get there. In the rubble, he found two of Hitler's photo albums filled with pictures of the famous politicians of Europe who had been Hitler's guests. An officer from the company demanded that Moore turn over the albums to him. Moore refused. The officer threatened to court-martial him. Moore was in Malarkey's platoon. Malarkey ran to Battalion HQ to see Winters. He explained the situation. Winters told his Jeep driver to take Malarkey back to his quarters and return with Private Moore and all his gear. When Moore arrived, Winters made him a driver for Battalion HQ. Thus was Moore able to take the albums home with him to Casper, Wyoming. With lodging taken care of and having looted more than they could carry or could ever hope to get home, the next thing these young Americans needed was a set of wheels. No problem. In the vehicle park in and around town, there were German Army trucks, sedans, Volkswagens, and more, while scattered through the town and in the garages attached to the hillside homes were luxury automobiles. Sergeant Hale got a Mercedes fire engine, complete with bell, siren, and flashing blue lights. Sergeant Talbert got one of Hitler's staff cars, with bulletproof doors and windows. Sergeant Carson got Hermann Göring's car, the most beautiful car I have ever seen. We were like kids, jumping up and down. We were kings of the road. We found Captain Spears. He immediately took over the wheel, and off we went through Berchtesgaden, through the mountain roads, through the country with its picture-book farms. As more brass poured into Berchtesgaden on May 7th and 8th, it was more difficult for a captain to hold on to a Mercedes. Spears got orders to turn it over to regiment. Carson and Bill Howell were hanging around the car when Spears delivered the sad message. Carson asked Howell if he thought those windows really were bulletproof. Howell wondered, too. So they paced off 10 yards from the left rear window, aimed their M1s, and fired. The window shattered into 1,000 pieces. They gathered up the broken glass and walked away just as a captain from regiment came to pick up the car. Before Talbert turned over his Mercedes, he too did some experimenting. He was able to report to Winters that the windows were bulletproof, but that if you used armor-piercing ammo, it would get the job done. Winters thanked him for his research, agreeing that one never knew when this kind of information would come in handy. The men tried another experiment. They drained the water from the radiator of the Mercedes to see if it could run without it. With a third luxury car, they decided that before turning it in, they would see if it could survive a 30-meter crash, so they pushed it over a cliff. So the brass got luxury automobiles without windows or water or wrecks. Talbert's Mercedes burned out the engine trying to climb the road to the Eagle's Nest. The men ended up with trucks, motorcycles, Volkswagens, scout cars, and the like, which were good enough. And anyway, the fuel came as free as the vehicle. The Americans would just fill up and drive off. It was a unique feeling, Winters recalled. You can't imagine such power as we had. Whatever we wanted, we just took. With lodging and wheels taken care of, the next thing was liquor. Every cellar held some wine. But the greatest cache of all was discovered by one of the few non-drinkers in the battalion, Major Winters. On May 6th, scouting on his own, he found Göring's officers' quarters and club. In one room, he found a dead German general in full dress uniform, a bullet through his head, ear to ear, a pistol in his hand. He was a 2-star general later identified as Kastner. Winters wandered through, kicking open doors, when, Lord, I had never seen anything like this before. In a vaulted cellar, 15 meters by 10 meters, there were row after row of liquor racks stretching from floor to ceiling. The brand names covered the world. The later estimate was that the room held 10,000 bottles. Winters put a double guard on the officers' club entrance and another on the cellar, and he issued an order. No more liquor. Every man in the battalion was to go on the wagon for 7 days. Commenting in 1990 on this improbable order, Winters said, "Now, I am no fool. You don't expect an order like that to be carried out 100%, but the message was clear. Keep this situation under control. I don't want a drunken brawl." That afternoon, Winters called Captain Nixon to him. "Nix," he said, "you sober up, and I'll show you something you have never seen before in your life." The next morning, May 7th, Nixon came to Winters, sober, and asked, "What was that you said yesterday that you were going to show me?" Winters got a jeep, and they drove to the officers' club. When Winters opened the door to the cellar, Nixon thought he had died and gone to heaven. He was sure he had when Winters said, "Take what you want. Then have each company and battalion HQ bring around a truck and take a truckload. You are in charge. An alcoholic's dream come true. Paradise beyond description. First choice of all that he could carry from one of the world's great collections, then a chance to let his friends have all they wanted, and the perfect excuse to celebrate. The end of the war had come, and he was still alive. For the company as a whole, the celebration was grand and irresistible. Despite Winter's orders, and despite regular guard duty rotation, there was a party. There had to be. On May 7th, the Germans surrendered in Rennes to General Eisenhower, and word was flashed around Europe to cease fire. Take away the blackout curtains and let the light of peace shine out. News of the German surrender, Winston Churchill said, was the signal for the greatest outburst of joy in the history of mankind. The men of Easy Company saw to it that Berchtesgaden participated in that party to the full. Once the distribution of Goering's wine had taken place, Carson recalled that you could hear the champagne corks going off all day long. As the celebration got noisier, Captain Spears began to grow a bit worried that it would become excessive. Sergeant Messier, remembered by Private O'Keefe as our most professional soldier, got into the spirit of the day when he dressed in a full German officer's uniform, topped off with a monocle for his right eye. Someone got the bright idea to march him over to the company orderly room and turn him in at rifle point to Captain Spears. Someone got word to Spears before Mercier showed up. When troopers brought Mercier up to Spears' desk, prodding him with bayonets, Spears did not look up. One of the troopers snapped a salute and declared, "Sir, we have captured this German officer. What should we do with him?" "Take him out and shoot him," Spears replied, not looking up. "Sir," Mercier called out. "Sir, please, sir, it's me, Sergeant Mercier." "Mercier, get out of that silly uniform," Spears ordered. Shortly thereafter, he called the company together. He said he noted that the men who were relatively new to the company were celebrating out of proportion to their contribution to the victory. He wanted it toned down. No more shooting off of weapons, for example. And especially not of German weapons, which made everyone jumpy when they went off. But trying to stop the celebration was like trying to stop the tide. Not even Spears could resist. Back in Company HQ, he and Sergeant Carson sat in the orderly room, popping champagne bottles, throwing the empties out the French doors. Soon there was a pile of empties outside. Spears and Carson went to the balcony for some fresh air. They looked at the bottles.
"Are you any good with that .45 pistol?" Spears asked.
Carson said he was. "Let's see you take the neck off one of those bottles." Carson aimed, fired, and shattered a bottle. Spears took his turn with the same results. Soon they were banging away. Sergeant Talbert came storming in, red-faced, ready to shoot the offenders of the company order. He saw Carson first. "Carson, I'll have your ass for this," he shouted. Just as he started explaining that Captain Spears had ordered no shooting, Spears stepped out from behind Carson, a smoking .45 in his hand. After a few seconds of silence, Spears spoke.
"I'm sorry, Sergeant. I caused this. I forgot my own order."
Webster, Lutz, and O'Keefe had meanwhile found their way to Goering's wine cellar. They were late. The other Easy men had already been there, and Winters had withdrawn the guard, throwing the cellar open to anyone. As Webster, Lutz, and O'Keefe drove to the site in Lutz's Volkswagen, they saw a steady stream of German trucks, Volkswagens, even armored cars winding up the road to the officers' club. The last contingent of E Company men had a wooden box with them, which they stuffed with bottles. "I was shocked to find that most of the champagne was new and mediocre," Webster remarked. Here was no Napoleon brandy, and the champagne had been bottled in the late 1930s. I was disappointed in Hitler. What Webster failed to take into account was that Nixon had preceded him, and Nixon was a connoisseur of fine liquor, and he had picked out 5 truckloads for himself and the other officers long before Webster, also a self-styled connoisseur, arrived. "On this occasion," an amused Winters commented, "the Yale man, Nixon, pulled his rank on the Harvard boy." Outside the club, Webster, Lutz, and O'Keefe ran into a group of French soldiers drinking, shouting, "La guerre est finie! La guerre est finie!" shooting their machine pistols into the sky, slapping the Americans on the back, asking for cigarettes, offering drinks. The Americans gave away cigarettes, shook hands all around, and took off, driving back to their apartment as fast as possible. And there, Webster wrote, began a party unequaled, popping corks, spilling champagne, breaking bottles, raucous laughter, ringing shouts, stuttering, lisping sentences.
"Have an usher glass. Here, goddammit, let me pop that cork. It's my turn. Isn't this wonderful? Schlug-a-lug, fill her up. Where's Hitler? We gotta thank Hitler, this son of a bitch. Berchtesgaden, I love you."
And that was the end of the war. Everyone in Europe was celebrating, victor and vanquished. First among the celebrants were the young men in uniform. They had survived. They would live. They had the best cause to celebrate. On the morning of May 8th, O'Keefe and Harry Lager went looking for eggs. They came to a farmhouse in a clearing, smoke curling up from the chimney. They kicked the door in, then ran inside with rifles ready to fire and scared hell out of the two Italian deserters who jumped straight up and froze. There was a bottle of champagne on the table. With one quick motion, the Italian nearest it grabbed the neck of the bottle, stuck it out toward O'Keefe, whose rifle was pointed straight toward his stomach, and offered a drink, saying, "Pax!" The tension snapped. They drank to peace. The Americans left to continue their egg hunt. They came to a lodge in the woods. It was beautifully situated, O'Keefe wrote. A man in his late 20s in civilian clothes was standing on a low porch at the front of the house. As we came to the steps leading up to the porch, he stepped down with a smile on his face and said in English, "The war is over. I have been listening to the wireless." He was holding himself erect, but it was noticeable that he had a bad right leg. I glanced at it. He explained, "I was with the Africa Corps and was shot up badly and sent home. I was a soldier." He asked us to come in and have a glass of wine. We said no, but he said, "Wait, I'll bring it out." And he left to reappear with three glasses of wine. We raised them in salute, as he said, "To the end of the war." We raised ours and we all drank. There was something basically soldierly and right about it. They found some eggs, returned to their apartment, and celebrated the end of the war with scrambled eggs and Hitler's champagne. Chapter 18. The Soldier's Dream Life. Austria, May 8th through July 31st, 1945. Late on the afternoon of May 8th, Winters got orders to prepare 2nd Battalion to move out that night for Zell am See, Austria, some 30 kilometers south of Berchtesgaden, where it would take up occupation duty. At 2200 hours, the convoy began to roll, headlights on full beam. In the back of the trucks, the men continued their party, drinking, singing, gambling. When the convoy arrived at Zell am See in the morning, the men were dirty, unshaven, wearing grimy army fatigue pants and blouses. German soldiers were everywhere. Zell am See was as far south as the Wehrmacht could retreat. Beyond it were the peaks of the Alps, and beyond them, Italy. And all the passes were still closed by snow. There were, it turned out, about 25,000 armed German soldiers in the area of responsibility of 2nd Battalion, which numbered fewer than 600 men. The contrast in appearance was almost as great as the contrast in numbers. The conquering army looked sloppy, unmilitary, ill-disciplined. The conquered army looked sharp, with an impressive military appearance and obvious discipline. Winters felt that the German soldiers and Austrian civilians must have wondered, as they gazed fascinated at the first American troops to arrive in the area, how on earth they could have lost to these guys. Winters set up Battalion HQ in the village of Capron, 4 kilometers south of Zell am See. The valley was one of the most famous mountain resort areas in the world, especially popular with rich Germans. The accommodation, ranging from Zimmer frei at farmhouses to luxurious hotels, were stunning. All the rooms were occupied by wounded German soldiers. They had to move out, to be sent by truck or train to stockades in the Munich area. The Americans moved in. Their job was to maintain order, to gather in all German soldiers, disarm them, and ship them off to POW camps. Winters got started the morning of May 9th immediately upon arrival. He had the senior German commander in the area brought to him. "I was 27 years old," Winters recalls, "and like all troops, I was wearing a dirty, well-worn combat fatigue jacket and pants and had that bucket on my head for a helmet. I felt a little ridiculous giving orders to a professional German colonel about 20 years my senior, who was dressed in a clean field uniform with his medals all over his chest." Winters gave his orders anyway. He directed the colonel to see to the collection of all weapons in the area and to stack them in the airport, at the school, and in the churchyard. He gave officers permission to keep their sidearms and allowed German military police to retain their weapons. And he said that the following day he would inspect the German camps, troops, and kitchens. The next morning, May 10th, Winters and Nixon drove by jeep to inspect the arms dumps. They were shocked by what they saw. In all three locations, a mountain of weapons. Winters realized he had made a mistake when he said all weapons. He had meant military weapons, but the colonel had taken him too literally. There was a fantastic collection of hunting rifles, target rifles, hunting knives, antique firearms of all kinds, as well as a full division stock of military weapons. It seemed enough to start World War III. When he inspected the camps and kitchens, Winters found everything well organized. Troops were lined up for review, looking parade ground sharp, clean, well-dressed, in good condition. The kitchens were in good order. The cooks were making large kettles of potato soup over fires. Thereafter, Winters dealt with an English-speaking German staff officer who came to his HQ each morning to report and receive orders. There was no trouble. In Winters' words, "We left them alone. They respected us." The German staff officer would tell stories about his tour of duty on the Eastern Front and of fighting against the 101st in Bastogne. He told Winters, "Our armies should join hands and wipe out the Russian army." "No thanks," Winters replied. "All I want to do is get out of the army and go home." That was what nearly everyone wanted, none more than the German troops. Before any could be released, however, all had to be screened. The German encampments were crawling with Nazis, many of whom had put on enlisted men's uniforms to escape detection. The most notorious of these was Adolf Eichmann, wearing the uniform of a Luftwaffe corporal in a camp near Berchtesgaden. He managed to escape before he was detected, got to Argentina with his family, and lived well until 1960, when Israeli agents discovered his whereabouts, captured him in a daring commando raid, brought him to Israel for trial, and hanged him. Lieutenant Lipton was serving as leader of the machine gun platoon in HQ command, 2nd Battalion. Winters assigned him to oversee a lager of several hundred prisoners. One of them was Ferdinand Porsche, designer of the Volkswagen and the Panther and Tiger tanks. In mid-May, Lipton cleared about 150 of the prisoners for release. The senior German officer, a colonel, asked permission to talk to them before they were let go. Lipton agreed. His talk was long and was a good one, Lipton recalled. He told them that Germany had lost the war, that they had been good soldiers and he was proud of them, and that they should go back to their homes and rebuild their lives. He said that all of them were needed for the reconstruction of Germany. When he finished, the men gave a loud cheer and took off. Other high-ranking German officials, men who had good reason to fear that they would be charged with war crimes, were hiding in the mountains. Spears was told by the DPs about a man who had been the Nazi head of the slave labor camps in the area and had committed a great many atrocities. He investigated, asked questions, and became convinced they were telling the truth. Further investigation revealed that this man was living on a small farm nearby. Spears called in 1st Lieutenant Lynch. He explained the situation, then gave his order.
Take Moon, Liebgott, and Sisk. Find him and eliminate him.
Lynch gathered the men, explained the mission, got a weapons carrier, and took off up the mountain. During the trip, Moon thought about his predicament. He was sure that Captain Spears did not have the authority to order an execution based on testimony from the DPs. But Spears was the company's CO, and Moon was just an enlisted man carrying out an order. He decided, "I'm not complying with this bullshit. If someone has to do the shooting, it won't be me." They got to the farm and, without a struggle, took the Nazi prisoner. Liebgott interrogated him for 30 minutes, then declared there could be no doubt this was the man they wanted, and he was guilty as charged. The Americans pushed the man at gunpoint to the weapons carrier, then drove off. Lynch stopped beside a ravine. They prodded the man out of the vehicle. Liebgott drew his pistol and shot him twice. The prisoner began screaming. He turned and ran up the hill. Lynch ordered Moon to shoot him. "You shoot him," Moon replied. "The war is over." Skinny Sisk stepped forward, leveled his M1 at the fleeing man, and shot him dead. After the POWs and DPs were sorted and shipped out of the area, the next job was to sort out and consolidate all the captured German equipment and the U.S. Army equipment no longer needed for combat. As the material was gathered and registered, convoys of trucks took it to depots in France. Officers were ordered to turn in the silk escape map of France they had received before the jump into Normandy or be fined $75. As those maps were damn near sacred to the D-Day veterans, there was universal non-compliance. When told to pay the fine, Winters replied for the entire battalion, taking his line from General McAuliffe, "Nuts!" The regimental supply officer, Captain Herbert Sobel, backed down. Given the absence of resistance, indeed the enthusiastic cooperation of the Germans and Austrians, by the end of the third week in May, there was little real work left for the Americans. All KP, washing clothes, cleaning quarters, or construction tasks were done by local residents anxious to make some money or receive food or cigarettes. Time was hanging heavy on the heads of the young men lusting to go home. Winters had a track built, a tennis court, and a baseball field, then a rifle range. Competitions were held between companies, battalions, regiments, all the way up to ETO. He held daily close-order drills. There were men who loved it. To the serious athletes, those with hopes of a future college or professional career, it was a marvelous opportunity to train. They were excused from all duties, lived in a separate athletic dorm, and got to practice or compete every day. To the few who planned to make a career of the Army, it was a chance to practice their profession. But to the majority, neither jocks nor career soldiers, it was a bore. They found their outlets in four other ways: as tourists in the Alps, hunting, drinking, and chasing women. The Zeller Zee, a lake some 4 kilometers in length and 2 in width, was a breathtaking bit of beauty and a joy to swim in on the long, sunny days of late May and early June. "My bathing suit is getting quite a workout," Webster wrote his mother on May 20th. "Will you please mail me another of very gaily colored trunks from Abercrombie & Fitch as quickly as possible? Waist 32, preferably shorts, not trunks." On the mountain behind Capron was a ski lodge. The chairlift to the lodge was kaput, but it could be reached by climbing the mountain trail. Winters set up a program to rotate one platoon every 3 days to the lodge for R&R. At the lodge, there were Austrian servants and cooks, ski instructors and hunting guides. The skiing was fabulous. So was the hunting for mountain goats. There were deer at a lower level, hundreds of them, as this was a prime hunting area for the European aristocracy. The 101st was at the end of the pipeline in the distribution of food. Everyone from the ports of Cherbourg and Le Havre right on down the pipeline had a crack at the food first, and they all had civilian girlfriends to take care of and a flourishing black market to tempt them. So not enough food was getting to the Alps. The paratroopers went out on hunting parties for deer. Venison became a staple in the diet. Private Freeman got a Browning shotgun and supplemented the venison with quail and other birds. Women, broads, dames, beetles, girls, skirts, frails, molls, babe, fräuleins, mademoiselles. That's what the boys wanted, Webster wrote. He went on to describe the results. The cooks were keeping mistresses. The platoon lovers were patronizing the barn. McCreary had a married woman in town. Reese installed his in a private house. Carson fed an educated, beautiful, sophisticated Polish blonde, whom he later married. The platoon staff visited a DP camp nightly, and in Zell am Zee, home of the most beautiful women in Europe, the lads with the sunburned blondes were fulfilling their dreams. After talking about women for 3 years, they now had all they could want. It was the complete failure of the non-fraternization policy. For those who had wanted and could afford them, there had been women in London, Paris, along the Ruhr. But Webster observed, in Austria, where the women were cleaner, fairer, better built, and more willing than in any other part of Europe, the GIs had their field day. The flow of booze was never ending. On May 28th, Webster wrote his parents, "Since leaving Berchtesgaden, we've had a bun on every night. 2 days ago, we hijacked a German Wehrmacht warehouse to the tune of a couple of cases of gin, 48 bottles all told. Your package with the orange juice powder, therefore, came in very handy." Captain Spears had only one standing order about the drinking. No drunkenness outside. This was strictly enforced by the sergeants, who wanted no incidents with drunken soldier boys on guard duty or just wandering the streets and mountain paths. In their quarters, however, the men were free to drink all they could hold. Most of them drank more than that. Webster's squad kept a pitcher of iced tea and gin full and handy. Each night, he wrote, by 8 o'clock, Matthews was lisping and stuttering. Marsh was bragging about his squad and how they obeyed him. Schulte was sitting quietly on a bed, grinning. Wynne was laughing and shouting and talking about Baston. McCreary was boasting of his courage. "There ain't nobody in this platoon braver than I am, buddy," with immodesty but complete truth. Gilmore was pressing clothes furiously, a peculiar and most welcome manifestation of his high spirits. Hale slobbered and poured himself another drink. Chris, who never got rowdy, sat back in cold silence. Raider had passed out in the armchair, and I, who had passed out gracefully and without a struggle, was sound asleep. The lads would work off their hangovers with an afternoon swim or game of softball. Winters was a non-drinker who neither approved nor disapproved of drinking. His two best friends, Welsh and Nixon, were heavy drinkers. He never berated anyone for getting drunk on his own time. Had he ever been tempted to do so, he got a reminder each afternoon of why these excesses were taking place. The boys would wear shorts and nothing else in the warm sun while they played softball. Nearly every one of them had at least one scar. Some men had two, three, or even four scars on their chest, back, arms, or legs. "And keep in mind," he concluded, "that at Caprun, I was looking only at the men who were not seriously wounded." There was another reminder of the price that E Company and the others had paid to get to where they were. On June 5th, at 2200 hours, the men celebrated the first anniversary of their jump into Normandy. Webster was struck by the contrast. "A year earlier, at 2200 hours, my heart was beating like Jean Krupa's drum, and my stomach was tied up and very empty. Now I am sitting in a cozy house in the Austrian Alps. I have a tall glass of iced tea and gin in one hand, my pen in the other. A lot of boys who took off from that Devonshire airport are dead, buried in lovely cemeteries in Sainte-Mère-Église, Zon, and in Belgium. But I'm still here and very thankful for it, and tonight we shall remember them in a way they would have thought most fitting, by having a wild, noisy party." The officers, too, were having an ongoing party. Spears had snatched a couple of cases of fine brandy, which he enjoyed in his living quarters with a beautiful Polish DP and her small child. Colonel Sink gave some memorable parties at his HQ, the Hotel Zell. One night he invited all 506 officers to meet General Taylor and his staff. It was a bash. Colonel Strayer, who, according to Lieutenant Foley, could put away quite a bit of liquor, got a little rambunctious. He got into a fist fight with a general. Lieutenant Foley and a couple of others got a bright idea. They went to the parking lot and siphoned most of the gas from General Taylor's Mercedes. It had belonged to Hitler. They thought it would be very funny when it ran out of gas on his way back to Berchtesgaden in the middle of the night. The next morning, Sunday, Colonel Sink ordered a special officer's call. They assembled outside the hotel. Sink laid into them. He said their behavior was disgraceful. He touched especially on the brawling and on the practical joke. He had just gotten off the phone with General Taylor, whose car had run out of gas, and who had sat there for hours while his driver searched for a jerry can. Foley, who did not confess, reported that Sink didn't give a damn whether enlisted men stopped and listened. He was angry and he didn't care who heard him give every one of us hell, spelled H-E-L-L. Sink never stayed mad long. A week later, he laid on a huge 4th of July celebration. But on the 4th, it rained, and again on the 5th. Never mind, the 6th was a beautiful day, and the celebration began. Sink on the 6th, the men called it. There were athletic events of all kinds. Gliders and sailplanes sailed across the lake, riding the mountain currents. Troop Carrier Command lent the regiment a C-47 for the afternoon, and there was a jump of 12 men into the lake. Food and drink was plentiful. In the park, local musicians dressed in lederhosen played all the Pa tunes. The GIs requested pop songs from America, but the Austrians needed practice. Everyone danced. All the girls wore DP armbands. Non-fraternization applied only to Germans and Austrians. DPs were exempt. The armbands DPs wore to distinguish themselves were lavishly distributed to the local mountain girls. But as Lieutenant Foley remembered it, there wasn't one displaced person at the celebration. Mountain weather, unlimited sports, women and booze, easy duty, good hunting, and a hard-ass colonel whom everybody loved, Zell Amze provided, in Webster's view, the soldier's dream life. It should have been the most perfect summer ever for the men of E Company. In fact, after the first couple of weeks, most of them hated it. They were frustrated by the army bureaucracy. They were bored. They were drinking far too much, and they wanted to go home. Getting home depended on points, which became virtually the sole topic of conversation and led to much bad feeling. The point system set up by the Army gave a man points for each active duty service month, points for campaigns, points for medals, points for being married. The magic number was 85 points. Those with that many or more were eligible for immediate shipment home and discharge. Those with fewer points were doomed to stay with a division, presumably right on through to the big jump in China or Japan.
This is the end of Disc 11.